Welcome to episode 15 of Girls on Pop. I am your co-host, Marina Antunes, joined today by fellow co-host.
I'm Ashley Lynch.
We're back for more discussion. Are we over the drama of the last conversation? I don't know. I think so.
I think the drama just continues.
It just rolls over into the next thing, right? But you had some like awesome tweets this week. And I think it was this week, but the thing that really caught my eye that I wanted to start with, because it kind of feeds into some of the other stuff that I want to talk about today, but you had posted a link to an essay by R.S. Benedict, who I've never heard of in my life. I'd never even heard of the website, but it was called Everyone is Beautiful and No One is Horny, which is kind of freaking amazing.
Yeah, it's like this article kind of caught me off guard, but yeah, they do some incredible writing, and this one was like no different. And basically the premise is how, like, specifically with like the MCU, we've got this entire universe of characters and specifically actors who all kind of exist in like hypersexualized form. It's like we're seeing, like, especially the men, like, so buffed up like we've never really seen in films before, because of like the absurd kind of diet and training regimens that they go through to get in, you know, to look like Thor and Captain America for these films. And so what you end up with is these films that are full of eye candy for both men and women, and at the same time all of the sexuality has actually been removed from these films. No one thirsts after each other. No one's horny for each other. You never see characters having sex or even having like the inclination of wanting to have sex with each other. It just does not exist in this universe.
It's weird as hell. And one of the, and then of course I started thinking about all these movies that sort of come out that don't have sex anymore. Like, It used to be like you'd go to a movie and it was very typical for your leads to have like a romantic encounter. No big deal. It's sex. Things happen, of course. But like you think about it now, it's like that almost never happens anymore in movies. And when it does, it's like rated R. And it's like this big thing that you don't talk about. Oh my God, did you see what happened? Which I think made Bridgerton that much more interesting, because it like basically said, fuck that, we're going there. It really brought up some like really, really interesting ideas and observations, specifically because, I mean, the MCU is kind of like the biggest thing in Hollywood right now, right? Everybody wants to be a part of that universe. They kind of make the movies that everybody's watching, and they've kind of become like the de facto Are they really the de facto like adult entertainment now?
Well, it's like the prototypical blockbuster. So they're always aiming for the four quadrant area, which means they're going to be family friendly for the most part. But at the same time, to have even just the romantic elements of it, like you'll have relationships within the films, but to have any sort of sexual desire removed from those relationships is very interesting. And I think we'll kind of get into that a little bit also with, like, you know, talking about WandaVision and whatnot, because he's dealing with what is ostensibly a, you know, married suburban mom and dad couple. And it's very kind of desexualized in that way. And this goes across the board. And it's one of those things that you don't notice is missing until someone points it out to you. And then you look back and go, yeah, it wasn't there. And I was talking about with some people earlier, and we sort of remembered that the first Iron Man movie did have a little bit of these elements in it. And it being like the first film in the series, they were still trying to figure out their footing or whatnot. But it opens with Tony Stark taking a reporter home, and she wakes up in his bed and does the walk of shame. And then later he's on the plane with Rhodey, and, you know, he's like got stripper poles and the flight attendants are dancing, and it's supposed to be like, you know, he's a playboy to the absurd sort of degree. But Marvel very quickly dropped all of that right after that movie, and it's completely absent now.
Yeah, whereas DC leans into it. kind of okay with this.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, if your competition is going one direction, one thing you can do is go the exact opposite direction. That is not a bad strategy at all.
No, not at all. I mean, specifically, they're talking a lot about, the blockbusters of today, but I did think that it made for some interesting observations on where we are with just entertainment in general, because it seems like, I mean, for a long time, the discussion was, you know, North America is so prudent, they'll put an R or an X rating on anything that has sex in it. But you start talking about violence and like nobody cares. You can shoot up an entire room of people. Yeah. And it's rated PG-13 because who cares? That's a conversation that I guess always comes back, because I don't consider myself prudent. But I mean, considering the entertainment that's available, it's kind of like, oh, I've kind of become a bit of a prude, haven't I?
I think Canadians have a weird kind of cultural identity here, because so much of the culture that we sort of create and consider ourselves a part of tends to lean, I think, a little bit more European as a result of our roots. But at the same time, because of our proximity and because we essentially share the same sort of distribution platforms as the U.S., we have spent most of our lives being part of sort of like the cultural U.S. hegemony that, you know, comes out of that country, and consider ourselves sort of like part of that. So it's like we have like a sort of like split personality when it comes to our filmic intake in that way. But I've always been incredibly fascinated by tracking the trends of films and how they change over the years. And you were mentioning specifically how it used to be the case where you would see lots of sexuality in films. You know, almost you'd have obligatory nudity in films. And that's something that you just don't see anymore. And I think there's a couple reasons for it. One of it is just like trends change, you know, it's just not fashionable to a certain extent. And I think another one is just sort of like attitudes being more progressive about what it is we want to see in film and what voices we want to highlight. But I think the largest thing that caused that change was basically the internet. And once all of a sudden you had 24/7 always available free pornography that anyone could look up and find, all of a sudden the need for the Cinemax scene in a film of gratuitous nudity where the woman takes her top off no longer really has a purpose. It doesn't have a place. You can't sell a film on that when you can go to the internet and look up whatever the hell you want and whenever you want. So films stopped including that. Films stopped being about that. And as films started skewing kind of younger and younger, sort of like dedicating them more towards a 13-year-old boy audience as opposed to a 20-year-old adult audience, then you started to see the shift where the sexuality gets taken out of films. And I think we've seen it gradually over time. And some things have disappeared as a result, not just gratuitous nudity, but like the 90s were rife with the erotic adult thriller. And you see a lot of those films. And depending on where you sit, you know, you're either going to love or you're going to hate that genre of films. I particularly love some of those films. Some of them are trashy as hell, and I adore the hell out of them. I rewatched Color of Night with Bruce Willis a little while ago, which is such a goofy movie. But it's like, I miss having those adult erotic thrillers in my life, and they just don't exist anymore. But I think we are going to see them again. I think they're going to come back, and I think they're going to come back in a different form. And I think what we're probably going to see is we're going to start to see the erotic thriller through the lens of female filmmakers. And I think that's going to be interesting, where they're no longer going to be male gaze films.
That's an absolutely brilliant observation, and I never really considered that. But I'm with you. I totally miss those over-sexualized thrillers. They were, like you mentioned, they're so trashy, some of them, but they're so good. I really miss that sort of subgenre of movie, for sure.
I know, we definitely need it back.
Yes, yes, yes. Preferably through the female gaze. That would be amazing.
Yeah.
But this kind of plays into a bunch of stuff, and one of the things that I hadn't anticipated would kind of dovetail into it was there was a lot of buzz around the internet a couple of weeks ago when the first stills from the new Space Jam 2, well, it's not called Space Jam 2, I think it's called Space Jam the New something or other, but whatever, is coming out in a couple of months. And so they'd released the first couple of images and the internet went berserk because they changed the design of Lola Rabbit.
Space Jam, the new legacy.
Yes.
That's what it's called.
With LeBron James. I don't know. I thought this would be like the most innocuous thing. It's Space Jam. And then the internet went berserk because they changed her outfit. I'm like, are you for real? Like, I don't even know what to think anymore.
This is like the epitome of a non-story to me that just became like a big story.
Right?
Because it's... So, one of the big things that's circulated around the internet is this comparison of like, this is what Lola Bunny looked like before, and she's like very curvy and very sexualized, and then here's what she looks like now. Cancel culture has gone too far, and she's, you know, much more kind of like, you know, slimmed down and has a very similar physique to Bugs. She's not Jessica Rabbit anymore. But here's, and this got picked up by all the right-wing news, and they did their whole little pearl-clutching outrage about it. You know, they did the Dr. Seuss thing. Oh my God, they're taking away these books that no one's ever didn't even know existed. But here's the thing, that image that circulated, that A-B comparison, the first image isn't even from Space Jam. Apparently it was from like it's fan art from like a furry porn site or something like that.
I hadn't heard that part.
Yeah, it's not even from the Space Jam movie. So the thing that they're comparing to, look what they are taking away, they never had in the first place. It's so, such a nonsense story.
It's ridiculous. I mean, I'm not really 100% sure how I feel about this whole thing. I was curious about it because I had sat in on a conversation where a bunch of creators had been talking about the new images that they had released in comparison to the first film. And these are people that worked on the first movie. And there was a lot of discussion about when they had been asked to come back for the second movie. Most of them had said no for the reason that they didn't want to be involved in any drama that happened because there is so much of this. Anything that you change is going to be problematic. And a lot of people didn't want to have any involvement in that. Mm. And the producers were kind of like, well, you know, we had to make the movie anyways. So we took the opportunity to make the changes that we thought were wise to make for the current times. Mm-hmm. And it still backfired. Like, you just can't win. And then, of course, after the whole Lola Bunny thing, there was the and I don't know where this came from.
Pepe Le Pew, right?
Yeah, but the notice that Pepe Le Pew was not in the movie either because he's problematic. The character's problematic. I'm like, well, yes, the character's problematic, but I mean, we're not going to erase the character from history. Like, he's always going to be there. You're always going to be able to
go back and watch those cartoons.
Well, yeah, I mean, understandably, we're in a different place now, and we understand, or at least I hope that we understand the material differently. But I mean, every once in a while, I'm like, have we gone too far in like removing from the culture things that were previously okay? Like, does it make it any better to just pretend that that's not there, rather than like face it head on and actually deal with whatever is associated with that character? Like, I think the conversation is that they've cut a scene from the film in which actually somebody talks Pepe down and is basically like, well, no, that's not right anymore. And I'm like, okay, well, that's great. Why don't we have that in the movie? Like, if you take that out, you're not making anything better. You're just kind of ignoring this thing that's out in the world anyways. And you've made a bigger deal of it than it probably should have been.
You know, I think it probably would be a bigger deal if that scene were in the film. Because honestly, I get where they're coming from, but honestly, I think that scene sounds kind of cringy. I don't know. Maybe they could have pulled it off, but it's... I mean, from where I'm sitting, this is just how culture works. Culture constantly moves forward, changes, things get left behind, things evolve, things, you know, it's, we don't have to hold on to all of the things. It's still there. You can still go back and watch Pepe Le Pew cartoons if you want to. We aren't obligated to keep making Pepe Le Pew until the end of time.
Exactly.
We can come up with new stuff and we can rework the old stuff. This is just how culture works. And it's always been that way. So it's this conservative mindset of this traditionalist mindset of constantly needing to sort of reclaim the past and preserve it as if it were like frozen in amber. I've never understood this because honestly, this is the same argument that conservatives make for, you know, why you shouldn't be allowed to be queer or, you know, why women shouldn't be allowed to vote. You know, it's like, it's, we're supposed to move forward. We're supposed to change. That's what we do as a society. It's like, if you can't figure that out by your adult life, then you need to readdress where your priorities are, because you know where your priorities shouldn't be. It shouldn't be with a mega blockbuster cartoon animation film with basketball players that exist solely to sell sneakers to people.
Exactly.
That is not important.
No. And the other thing I find really interesting is that, I mean, we don't need this movie. That's just the reality of it.
Yeah.
The original at least had, was going for something. They were trying something new and they were breaking some rules as far as how the technology worked. So they were pushing the envelope in that way. This one doesn't do any of that. I mean, from the looks of it, it's fairly straightforward and that they're not breaking any boundaries or pushing any boundaries with the text. So for me, it's just like, whatever. It's a movie, like you say, to sell sneakers, sell toys, and get kids excited about I don't know what.
And, you know, that's just, that's kind of the state of the film industry as a whole right now, which is its own kind of little depressing little package to open up, is how we kind of drowned celebrity culture in a bathtub. But the thing that replaced it was celebrity of IP. It's now franchises. Anthony Mackie did a great interview where he said it great, where he said, Anthony Mackie is not a celebrity. Falcon is a celebrity. You know, it's like the Marvel characters, they are celebrities. The actors who play them, they're just the actors who don't get to enjoy a lot of celebrity outside of that role. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where the culture is now, where everything, it's about Star Wars. Who plays the Star Wars doesn't matter. It's about the Star Wars. And so in that sort of culture, the fact that they would dig up Space Jam and try to remake it for a new generation makes absolute financial sense from a studio perspective.
Yeah, for sure. That's an excellent, valid point. I hadn't considered that. The movie star is dead. Are they really?
There's a few of them left. It's like, you know, but who can still really open a movie now? It's like The Rock can open a movie, you know, to a degree Tom Cruise can still open a movie, but there's like
very few.
You don't have the thing anymore where people say, oh, let's go see the new Bruce Willis movie. What's it about? Doesn't matter. Bruce Willis is in it. You know, it's going to be good. You know, you don't have that anymore. That doesn't exist. And maybe that's a good thing, but I don't love what replaced it, which is a dedication to corporate owned properties, and which is always going to be the excuse for extending copyright law even further so that nothing ever becomes part of the public domain.
Oh, that's another discussion altogether. Oh my God.
I'm all about opening boxes of worms.
I me too. I'm to the point now where I cringe. The latest drama was not drama, but I guess Avatar surpassed the Avengers again for box office supremacy. And it's like, oh, wait, aren't they both Disney properties now? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I tweeted that out and I said, oh, thank God, Disney finally wrested control away from checks, notes, Disney.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's like, it gets exhausting. And honestly, it's, I get wanting to see a film that you care about do well, but in terms of like the sort of like box office race between movies. I've never enjoyed that. And I've never enjoyed it as kind of like a metric for the quality of a film. Because if films that made a lot of money meant that it were a good movie, then the Transformers franchise would be considered one of the pinnacles of high art. And I just don't hold to that. That is not my opinion. I think one of the worst things the film industry ever did was it decided to publicly publish the box office results for everyone to see and basically debate like sports statistics. I don't, what other industry just kind of regularly every week publishes, this is how much money this movie took in. The other industries don't do this. And it's starting to disappear a little bit because of how much has moved to streaming services, and streaming services are black box. They don't publish that stuff. You know something on Netflix is successful because Netflix told you so, and they don't give you any data to back that up. And you just have to trust that Netflix is not lying when they say a movie did really well for us. It's like, okay.
Exactly.
And maybe that's better.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I've never been a fan of the whole... I have a number of issues with the way that we measure the success of movies. I don't like Rotten Tomatoes. I don't like box office numbers. I hope those two things like die in the deepest bowels of hell. Mm-hmm. I don't care for either of them because they are not, like you say, they're not the measure of the quality of a project. And I mean, just because people go to see a movie on opening weekend doesn't mean that movie is actually any good. It just means everybody wants to see it first.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it's any good. I mean, I've seen lots of movies on opening weekend that I never watched again because I didn't like them. Mm-hmm. So that's not, I think you're right. It's not a measure of quality. So
I have ranted so much about the Metacritic scoring on Rotten Tomatoes and how people will use that as a metric for how good a film actually is. And it's like, no, you can't go by that. It's especially when you get into audience metascores for films. It's like, and now you have environments where people are writing bots to game those systems to try to prove that people don't like a movie or like a movie more than they really do. It's meaningless.
Yeah.
I've always said, just find a handful of critics who you genuinely agree with you. When they make their argument for why they think this about a specific film, you're like, yeah, I'm on board with that. I generally share your opinions. And then read what they write, you know. I've always felt that's the best way to go about it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
And watch more movies. That's my other thing.
I love it. So talking about watching movies, HBO had a little kerfuffle the other day. So apparently people that were that had bought Tom, because I'm assuming you have to buy Tom and Jerry. It was like an extra. Was it an extra? Or was it like?
No, I think it was just clicking on to watch it. I think it was just available to watch on the streaming service.
Yeah. So instead of Tom and Jerry, they got Justice League. I would have been okay with that problem, with that mistake.
Yeah. Like for whatever reason, someone screwed up something on the back end for HBO Max, and people who decided to click play on Tom and Jerry all of a sudden got treated to a 4-hour, you know, really dark superhero movie shot in one color. It's I'm sure it was a little bit of a shock. I don't think it was up for very long because I took a look and it doesn't look like Justice League ended up on any of the torrent sites. So I imagine if it had been up for any significant amount of time, people would have ripped the hell out of that movie. It would have been all over the internet by now. So it doesn't look like it was for very long, but I've always found it funny when people get the wrong movie. I remember a story a few years ago where I believe it was, God, I can't remember. It was some kids movie that everyone had sat down to, and someone had threaded up the wrong film, and instead they got shown Insidious. And it was like a big deal where it's like all these kids ready to be transported to a magical land of adventure. And suddenly they got greeted with a really dark horror movie. And there's something that's subversively funny about that whenever you end up with stories like that. But the bizarre thing is, because of all of the discourse around Justice League, and specifically Zack Snyder's films, and the fan base that has accumulated around that, they immediately went into overdrive with all these conspiracy theories about how it was a deliberate attempt from Warner Brothers to sabotage the film in a way which I'm not sure how this actually hurts the film by people accidentally getting to watch it. I don't get the sense that it was because they didn't get to watch it first, like that they're mad that they didn't get to see it. I honestly don't know what the complaint is, other than the fact that they just always feel like they need to be at war with someone.
They
started calling for executives at Warner Brothers to be like fired for this, and it's ridiculous.
I'm sometimes ashamed to admit that I am a Zack Snyder fan because of those fans. We are not all crazy. I promise you. I promise. I don't think I'm crazy.
Maybe my Twitter mentions say otherwise.
Well, I was going to say, you know, I don't know what anybody else thinks of me. I don't think I'm crazy, but who knows for sure? Who knows? But oh my God, so much drama. And I mean, it sounds, I didn't do a whole lot of reading about it, but it doesn't sound like anybody actually watched the entire movie. It seems like it was only up for like a portion of time, and then like somewhere in the middle, it kind of stopped right after like an hour.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's a 4-hour movie, and by the sounds of it, it's like before anyone could have even possibly watched the whole thing.
Yeah.
It had already been corrected and taken down. Yeah. But it was up just long enough for someone to notice and get the news out that like this had happened. And so more than anything, it's just like it's a light, entertaining story. It went up like a week early, and people who weren't expecting to see Justice League got a little taste of Justice League. A few little clips leaked online. You know, if I were going to be more cynical, I would even say that this is actually a really clever marketing stunt.
Now, that's pretty good. What I want to know is, how big is the overlap of fandom of people that will watch Tom and Jerry and Justice League?
Well, all I know is that I've decided to dedicate my life to restoring the Tom and Jerry cut.
What?
I think this is an important thing that we need to do, because obviously there's more Tom and Jerry that we haven't got to see. And I think it's important that the creator's true vision for Tom and Jerry be restored in its final 4-hour form, and we get to see that.
Snap. Oh, I will say I was a Tom and Jerry fan, and then they made the cat talk, and that was it. I was like, fuck this.
I have not seen this movie, but I know a few people who have basically got like handed it as assignment to review the movie. And one of my friends who I'm on another podcast with, it literally broke him, and he decided to stop being a film reviewer. After what? Watching Tom and Jerry, he was like, that's it. I can't do this anymore.
It can't be that bad.
I've heard it's pretty bad. So
I will, I'll report back. It's on my queue of things to watch in the next couple of weeks.
Okay. I look forward to you. It's like, you'll either be reporting that like, it's not as bad as everyone said it was, or you'll be a completely broken person and we'll know why.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of which, let's talk about some of the stuff that we've been watching. How about that segue?
That was the best segue ever. Nothing will ever top that.
Okay, so admittedly, I have not been watching a lot of stuff. But I will say this. I think actually, why don't you start? Because I've watched some of the stuff that you've watched and we can talk about it. Because I have not watched a lot.
I've been admittedly watching a lot of TV, but I specifically not spoken about this one because I kind of wanted to wait until we got to the end to actually talk about it, because that made sense. I'm kind of doing the same thing where, like, just preview. I've also been watching the Allen versus Pharaoh doc series on HBO, which I'm really digging and is really disturbing for a multitude of reasons. But there's one more episode to go, which airs tonight. I think it's tonight. So until I finish that series, I think let's talk about that then.
Sounds good.
But we've gotten to the end of WandaVision now, which has basically been like the current cultural obsession in this pandemic time for, you know, for a TV show watching that everyone on the internet sort of gathered around and invented all sorts of insane fan theories that didn't come true, which is kind of amazing and disturbing in its own right. But we got the entire series, and I loved the hell out of this show. I thought it was great. And for anyone who hasn't watched it, if you're one of the few people who haven't watched it, the concept is basically just that that Wanda and Vision from the MCU are essentially trapped in an evolving sitcom that starts in like the 1950s and progresses through the decades from what we recognize as sitcoms, as they essentially exist as like a normal family. And they go through trying to essentially live their lives and both unravel the mystery of what's going on around them. In the meantime, they also give birth to twin boys and raise them who have their own superpowers, and there's people who make cameos, and it's a big old mystery that kind of unravels towards the end, but ultimately becomes a story about Wanda dealing with her own grief and her own trauma of a lifetime of trauma, from having her parents killed in a bombing raid, to losing her brother in Quicksilver in Age of Ultron, and then to eventually losing Vision in Infinity War. And so she's had basically a string of everyone in her life being taken from her and dying. And she is all alone. And part of it is her essentially constructing this sitcom reality around her, where she can have her lover back and raise a family and have the happiness that she feels that, you know, was denied to her the entire time. And I thought it was a very interesting depiction of that. I also think it was something that could have only been done as a TV series, because not only, like, by the time you get to the end of this, you're like, well, this could have been a feature film, and is at the quality level of a feature film, of what you'd expect from an MCU film. Like, some of the production, you know, quality and design in the series, it's like, this is not what you expect from TV. This is incredibly high budget, high level stuff. But the entire conceit of the series dictates that it had to occur in an episodic format, and it actually assists the narrative storytelling in that way. And so they did it. They made a Marvel movie into a TV series, and it worked.
Yeah, I agree 110%. I don't think this could have been done any other way. I have mixed feelings. On the one hand, I really, really like the show, and I like the evolution of Wanda Maximoff. I thought that they handled the character really well, and the fact that she's not only dealing with, like you mentioned, she's working through a lifetime of grief, and also at the same time finding and coming into her powers, which I thought was really interesting in a really fascinating way. I think for me, the one disappointment that I have has nothing to do with the show, but kind of with the ancillary fandom that sort of arised around it. Because like anything else that's really super popular that everybody was watching at the same time, it's like as soon as it's live at 12:01 a.m., there's like, you know, a string of people that have already seen it. There's already speculation. There's already spoilers. And the whole thing just kind of gets really... it's draining to try to avoid being spoiled by something that literally came out 12 hours ago. So that for me was the only kind of thing that I didn't like about it. But generally speaking, I really did like the show. And I actually thought that the making of, they released a making of this past weekend, I guess on the Friday, a 55-minute sort of behind the scenes making of the series, which I thought was really, really fascinating. And I did think added another layer of sort of like impressiveness to the production, and the care that they took into not only the development of the story, but how that story was told and staying true to certain periods, depending on, you know, where they were in the storytelling. And I thought that that was actually like a nice addition and made me kind of take even more appreciation for the show. But yeah, no, I totally fully agree. I thought it was really, really well done, really well handled. And it was really nice to have a female superhero in the middle of, like, at the center of a story. And it's her story, and it's not really anybody else's story. Yes, Vision is there, but he's kind of like this other side character. It's really all about her. And I thought that was really, really great. So,
especially with these characters, because although we've seen them in multiple films, it's pretty much just been in the Avengers films. And so as a result, just because of the economics of time in these films and everything that needs to be fit in because of the large cast that are already in them, we've never really gotten much characterization from either of these characters. And it's always just like tiny little snippets to suggest the relationship that develops. And it all feels more or less like in hindsight that it was leading to this point where we could actually get a story about these two characters. And we get to delve into them a lot deeper than we ever even scratched the surface of in the Avengers films. And it's kind of a nice, it's really nice. I can't even find the word for it, but just that to have these characters be fulfilled in this way, to be like fully drawn three-dimensional characters and have arcs and have a story that we haven't gotten till this point, it feels like it's fulfilling the promise of what these characters were always sort of presented in the films. It's like, okay, finally, here's why I should care about Wanda and Vision. And before, honestly, it's like, okay, yeah, they're in a relationship, plot development, whatever. I kind of get it. And I just didn't really pay much attention to it. You know, it wasn't something I thought was, it wasn't dwelled on. It wasn't interesting. It was just kind of there in the films. But now I genuinely care about these characters. And one of the things that I think was particularly interesting, like I mentioned about how the show is basically like a portrayal of dealing with grief for Wanda and dealing with trauma. But one of the things that I found really interesting about it, and I think this is one of the complaints that some people have had, was that by the end, it's Wanda doesn't really atone for what is ostensibly a lot of damage that she did to a lot of people. She basically enslaved an entire town of people. And it's like when they're able to like break out of their spell for a moment, they're like, oh my God, I'm in hell. Save me. I need to get out of here. I want to see my family. It's like, it's genuinely horrific. Mm-hmm. And they are like trapped in a sitcom reality of her making. And she never really atones for that. And in some ways, you can make the argument that Wanda is the villain of WandaVision. But one of the things that I think is very interesting about it, and that I've never really seen anything else touch on in this way, is I think it makes the point that people who are dealing with grief and dealing with trauma, not only are they hurting themselves and in need of help, but they will oftentimes also, as a result of their trauma, hurt the people around them in trying to deal with their trauma. And that's a very difficult thing because you don't want to blame the person who's lashing out and doing destructive things because they're dealing with their shit and they're trying to recover from something which is, you know, very, very horrible and get back on to a productive track in their life. And we never really sort of talk about the damage that suffering people do to those around them. And I feel like this show with this conceit was able to touch on that because in Wanda's grief, she does incredible damage to the people around them. And at the same time, you're sympathetic to her because of everything that she's endured. It doesn't excuse what she did, but you understand why she did it and that this is oftentimes a byproduct of people dealing with grief and dealing with trauma, dealing with depression, is that they will hurt people around them that are trying to help.
Oh, that's an excellent, excellent point. Something that I hadn't considered, which really makes a lot of sense. Wow. The question now is, will anybody else kind of pick up on that? Because that's really, really good. That's kind of genius.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested to see where the story goes from here. And I mean, from what I understand, this WandaVision is, I mean, this is another first for Marvel is that this is basically the first leg in an arc of the story, which is going to be continued on through the next Spider-Man movie and into Doctor Strange 2.
Mm.
So from what I understand, Wanda is going to have a significant role in Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. And that is also going to play into Spider-Man, as we've seen with a lot of the casting that's already come out about that film, how they're bringing in everyone from the various Sony properties on that film, and which I think they're going to do in the same way that, you know, spoilers cover your ears if you haven't watched WandaVision yet and don't want to be spoiled. They bring back the actor who played Quicksilver in the Fox films as Quicksilver instead of, who is it, Aaron Taylor Johnson, who played him in Age of Ultron. And so all of a sudden it's like, whoa, did they just legitimize the Fox mutant cast in this MCU show? And it's a little bit of a red herring in the sense, because they don't actually do that, but it, you know, threw the fans for a loop as to what was going on. And it kind of, the best explanation I heard for it, and I think it's kind of brilliant, is that they were trying to get at how when you're someone who is grieving and trying to come up with your own sort of healing process, you will sort of attach yourself to things that aren't real, but you really want them to be real.
Mm.
And in this case, it's wanting her brother back. And if they brought back Aaron Taylor Johnson, then you would know it's like, oh, it's just a character brought back from the dead, or it's just like fake or whatever. But when you bring back a different actor to play the character, and particularly go to the Fox casting for it, and Wanda doesn't, she like pauses for a moment, but she's like accepts him immediately, like, this is my brother.
Yeah.
And it's because she wants to believe it and she's convinced herself of it. And that's kind of a brilliant way to use casting against the audience to get that point across. I think it was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, they really did some really interesting stuff. I was less interested in the fan theories than I was in the show itself.
Which everyone was convinced Mephisto was going to show up in the show. It's like every character in the show, they're like, oh my God, that's going to turn out to be Mephisto. And from what I heard there, and this is like sort of like a victim of COVID, is that the final episode was actually a lot more toned down than it was originally supposed to be. Apparently, mm-hmm. We haven't even mentioned Catherine Hahn yet.
And she was amazing.
Amazing in this film. She is as Agatha. And just everything about her, like even to the point of the reveal where they bring out the Agatha All Along theme song to show you how she was manipulating things all through. And just like, she is a brilliant force of nature in this show, and she absolutely helps bring this thing to life, and she's probably the MVP of this entire thing. But apparently for the last episode, there was going to be like a much larger scene where her familiar, I think it's the rabbit, turns into basically like a giant demon monster that Vision has to fight. And I guess both Darcy and my God, I'm forgetting her name. Monica's daughter.
Oh, Rambo.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Apparently they were supposed to have larger parts in the finale, but it just became a logistical impossibility with the restraints that COVID put on finishing the show, that they weren't actually able to do all the visual effects for that stuff. So a lot of that stuff had to be pared down. And honestly, I don't mind. I liked it kind of pared down a little bit. I liked the way the Vision subplot or concluded, where he essentially like logics his double out of a fight. And it'll be interesting to see where that goes in the future, because, you know, now there's like a new Vision out there in the world who ostensibly has Vision's memories, but what's that Vision going to be? It's like, we don't know. It's like, this interesting evolution of the character. It's like, okay, well, they brought him back. We'll see where it goes. Sort of.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? And he may not even have a relationship with Wanda anymore. Who knows? Maybe she's seen some shit and she's on her own journey. And
exactly.
The show ends with her going off to the Incredible Hulk cabin to figure herself out.
I love it. I love it. I actually did really like that ending. I thought it was really well done. Overall, I really enjoyed the show. I thought it was really well done.
One other thing I just wanted to pitch, though. This is my nerdy fan theory thing. Now, I know that I am far from the first person to mention this, although I had, you know, like many people, I had this inclination right off the bat where they were absolutely in love with the dynamic that you got between Darcy and Jimmy Woo, the FBI agent, and how everyone wants to see essentially like an X-Files type show in the MCU starring these characters. Brilliant. I absolutely wanted it from episode one, as soon as he like did the close-up magic and whipped out his card, I'm like, I want this. I that's exactly what I want. And then into this, as I'm going to show my comic nerd cred here, into the show, they introduced the Darkhold, which is the Book of the Dead. And Marvel did have, like, post-X-Files, they tried to create their own X-Files-type comic, which was all centered around the Darkhold, which had human non-superhero characters basically trying to recover pages from this book, the Darkhold, to stop it from ending up in the hands of bad people. And they get into basically mystical adventures as a result. And so I'm like, there's your show right there. I want to see the Darkhold series starring Darcy and Agent Wu. And I think it would be amazing.
I'm in for anything.
So Kevin Feige, call me. I've got a treatment already. We can do this.
I'm up for anything with Darcy in it because she's great.
Absolutely. I was just glad to have her back because she was like one of those little great elements that was peppered into the first two Thor movies where I'm just like, God, I want more of her. And it's like, I always wanted her to come back. And so it was, it was really nice to see her come back into a more substantive role.
Agreed. I love Kat Dennings. Cast her in more things, people.
Absolutely.
What else you got?
All right. So the other thing that I've been watching is I finally dove into the TV series Ted Lasso on Apple TV Plus. And I've been putting off the show for a long time. And honestly, the specific reason is I just don't like sports. I hate sports. I hate sports in all their forms. I hate even the existence of sports. When the Super Bowl is on, I genuinely get irritated because Twitter is all about sports. I just don't like sports. That's me. And so if a show or a movie is about sports, it's not that I'm completely incapable of enjoying it, but it's got to really work hard to win me over. And it's got to really work hard to get me to go out of my way to watch something because I don't care. And I had heard so much acclaim about Ted Lasso for so long, people raving about it. And then Jason Sudeikis won a Golden Globe for it.
In his fucking sweatshirt. I will never
I swear he was stoned during that whole
time. Probably. Too,
which, you know, poggers. And so I finally broke down. I had enough people just telling me how great the show was and telling me how much you did not have to care about sports to enjoy the show. And so I finally dove into it and watched it because I'd heard it was nice, it was light, it was good-hearted. And so I wanted to finally check it out. And this show won me over. I
feel like everybody won that. It's because it's really so good.
Good. And so the premise, if you're not aware, is basically in London, a soccer team or football team, as it's known in the UK, and well, everywhere except the US, essentially, is basically taken over by the ex-wife of the previous owner. She basically gets the soccer team in the divorce. And so she decides to get back at my cheating ex-husband. I'm going to destroy the one thing he loved, his soccer team. And so what does she do? She fires the coach and decides to hire, I believe, like, I don't remember what he was coaching before. It was like lacrosse or something.
No, it was American football, but college football, the college level or something.
Yeah, it's so basically a guy that you would not hire to come over to London and plus up your, you know, professional league soccer team. They hire this guy from Kansas and bring him over. And the Ted Lasso to coach this team. No one wants him there. The owner just like, please just destroy this team and leave me alone. And the team immediately hates him. There's immediately a whole bunch of, I don't know if I want to call it discrimination, but a bias against him for being American, for being a stupid American in that sense. And he comes... What I find interesting is like it's the type of story where normally it'd be like, oh, he's the well-meaning doofus who like fails his way into succeeding by being such a pure-hearted idiot that he doesn't know he's winning sort of thing. That's what you kind of expect, but it's not that. It's he is a well-meaning guy who is smart and knows what he's talking about and it's just so good-natured that he knows I will win over everyone with my good nature, and I am unflappable in this mission that eventually these people will stop hating me. I will make them stop hating me, and we will all come together, and we will be friends, and we will be a better team because of it. And he does that. You get to watch the process of him winning over people who hate his guts, and it is so endearing. It is so enjoyable. It's so uplifting. It feels good to watch.
Yeah,
and it's genuinely enjoyable, and it's funny in a way that I would not expect it to be funny. Like some of the jokes, it's like they come so far out of left field that I genuinely don't expect them. The one that like caught me so off guard was like he's having a conversation with one of the footballers. The dude walks away, and it's like as many people outside of the U.S. will do to end the conversation. The footballer says cheers and walks away. And Ted Lasso responds by saying night court. And I burst out laughing and had to pause the show for 5 minutes because I could not stop laughing. It's the stupidest joke in the world that I had to think about for 30 seconds why it was funny. And I was just, I was not expecting that joke at all. And it's just like so silly. And on some level, that's what the show's operating on. But it's like more, as much as it is a comedy, it's very much a drama as well. And yeah. It is just top notch across the board, and it will win over your heart.
I agree. I mean, I was sold from the get-go because I am a football fan, most because, you know, if you're European and you're not, then you're not truly European. It is what it is. So as a Portuguese loving footballer, I was like, okay, let's give this show a go. And I mean, I think that you nailed it. The thing that's so good about it is that it is not, like it's genuinely a happy show. Like it's not a show that's pretending to be anything other than what it is. And there's no like hidden message. There's no like, it's not trying to be something that it's not. It's not trying to be serious and then be funny. It just is what it is. It just puts out this goodness into the world, and it just, it's impossible not to like it. It's just so charming. So charming.
And it's just, it's so wild to just watch a show where like the entire obstacle is people don't like me. And then the resolution is I made them like me.
Yeah.
That is the conflict throughout the entire show. And it like, you know, shows up in its various forms because the players have their different idiosyncrasies. I can't even say it. And they deal with each other in different ways, and they have completely different personality ticks, and everyone has, every player gets fleshed out and sort of given like their own sort of like problem that they need to overcome. Yeah. Like the captain of the team is this guy who's aging out of football and is a perpetually angry guy, but Ted Lasso goes to work on him and gets him to essentially come together with the team and redirect his anger into whipping the team into shape and putting that anger on the field instead of like directing it at the other teammates and at his own life. And well, everyone as a result starts to become a better version of themselves.
Worth noting that the actor that plays the role, Brett Goldstein, is also one of the writers on the show.
Okay.
Can you tell I'm knee deep in Ted Lasso lore?
I can.
I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan. I've basically told everybody they need to watch it, including my parents. My dad loves it. So
yeah.
I feel like I've won at the world.
So I did the whole long wind up about how I don't like sports, specifically to try to lure in people who are like me and avoid shows and movies that are about sports, because that just doesn't appeal to you. And it's like, if I fell in love with this show, I guarantee you will.
You will too. Yay. You had one. I think you had one more. You had movies. You had a couple of movies.
Yes, I've got a bunch of stuff. Well, I've got some stuff. So, movies I've watched. I watched most recently, by recently I mean last night, the film Escape from Pretoria, which is a recent film. I think it just came out this year, starring Daniel Radcliffe and directed by Francis Annan. And this is a true story about a group of men who were imprisoned in South Africa for protesting against apartheid.
Mm.
And what they essentially do is the entire film is them launching their escape plan to get out of prison. And so they go through this very long process of trying to learn the geography of the prison and essentially start to handcraft keys to all the doors out of pieces of wood that they're able to salvage from the workshop and try to basically get all of the doors open. And it, like every time they get one door open, it's like they find, oh, here's another door beyond that. And these six keys that I've handcrafted out of wood with like a filing knife don't fit this lock. So now we need to figure this lock out. And they literally spend about 300 nights where they sneak out of their cells during the night and get a little bit further through the prison. And it becomes this really tense cat and mouse, because it's like at any point, if these guys get caught, they're going to be killed. They're just going to be straight up murdered. And they just keep getting a little bit further and a little bit further out of this prison. And it's a really tense thriller of a film. It's also really interesting to see Daniel Radcliffe do a South African accent, which, you know, I'm not South African, so I can't say. Maybe someone who is can weigh in a little bit more on how successful he is or isn't with the accent. But, you know, I thought it sounded acceptable to me. So it's I thought he did a good job. But it was, you know, it's not the greatest film in the world, but it's definitely worth watching. And I thought it was was really thrilling. And I think anything that sort of highlights some of the atrocities that occurred under apartheid in South Africa is probably a good thing. And this film sort of like wraps that up inside of a prison break thriller. And we don't get too many prison break thrillers. So I thought it was really interesting and I enjoyed it.
Awesome.
All right. Do you have anything on your list, or keep going through mine?
I have one, because
let's go to your one then, because I want to hear something you've been watching.
Okay, because I know that you have one more on your list that I've seen that I have thoughts on, but the one that I've seen, and I actually just saw this the day before yesterday, and I cannot believe this movie has been hiding on me for like 2 years. It came out in 2019. It's called Rose Plays Julie. It's by a writing directing team. It's Irish, and it's by a writing directing team of Joe Lawler and Christine Molloy. And it is about this young woman whose mother, who's adopted, and she found out a number of years ago that she was adopted, and her mother died. She's in vet school, and she, for reasons, decides that she's going to try to find out who her birth mother is. And this launches this like super dark and really fascinating thriller that, you know, she, and eventually she meets her birth mother, finds out the circumstances of her birth, and then tries to kill her father. Or at least that's the intent. Wow. Yeah, it gets, it's dark. It's very, very dark. And it's really, really good. And the score is stupendous. And I, like I say, I can't believe this movie has been hiding on me for like 2 years. It's brilliant. I would highly recommend it. It does have, I guess it comes with some trigger warnings because it's about rape and they do get into some murky territory, but it's really, really well handled. And overall, the performances are just stupendous. I really can't believe this movie's been like under a rock. It's finally getting, I think it's now available to stream in the US, which is how it came sort of across my desk. But it's just so good. And Aidan Gillen is such a good bad guy. Like every time he shows up on screen, I'm like, you're going to be bad and I'm going to love you for it. And then there was the one time he showed up in a musical singing and I was like, what? But yes, Littlefinger continues to be creepy as shit. And it's
really, his default mode.
It is his default mode and he's really, really good at it. And this movie is so good on so many levels. I highly, 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 highly recommend it.
I will definitely add that to the list because that sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's probably one of the best things I've seen so far this year. It really blew me away. I was so impressed by it. So that it's called Rose Plays Julie. High marks from me. What else you got?
Awesome. So another film that I watch is the movie Boss Level, which is on Hulu. And it is from director Joe Carnahan. The Gray and Narc and Smokin' Aces. And, you know, it's like one of those man's man type of directors in every possible way. And this movie, it's basically like a Groundhog Day type film. We've actually gotten a lot of Groundhog Day type films in the last couple of years, which is, wow, for all sorts of reasons. But this one stars Frank Grillo. It starts off like right away on like day 400, and it's every day he wakes up and there's all of these professional assassins that are coming to kill him, and every day he fails to get away and they kill him. And he's trying to figure out what's going on, why he's caught in this time loop, and you know, how to get out of it, essentially. And it becomes sort of like the Groundhog Day thing, where it's like with each successive day, it's like, you know, he found out on day three, it's like, well, if I jump out my window at this time, then I can land on the bus. But the first time I tried it, I timed it too late and the bus ran over me, sort of thing. And so there's a lot of that sort of thing, you know, and he's sort of like playing to do the perfect run of a game level, essentially. And the movie presented in that sense, I mean, it's called Boss Level. There's like Nintendo-like graphics that come up to tell you exactly what day that they're showing you. And there's even like depictions of video games there's a scene where he goes to an arcade and hangs out with his estranged son. So it's very much kind of like trying to steep itself in the language of a video game to sort of justify the conceit of it, even though I'm not sure it's necessarily needed. But it's what you would expect. Like I think comparing to Smokin' Aces is probably a very good comparison for what to expect for this film. It's silly, it's over the top, it's ultra violent. And if you're on its level, it's gonna be kind of goofy, gory fun. And that's exactly what the film is. One of my favorites is there's a character played by Selena Lowe, who is one of the assassins that comes after him with a katana. And every time that she kills him, and she kills him a lot of times, she has this catchphrase, she says, where she basically does the kill stroke and just goes, "I am Wan Yin, and Wan Yin has done this." And you hear that like over and over, but she is so fun in the movie, and watching him just like try to beat her and constantly get sliced and diced, it's actually genuinely funny.
You had me at Frank Grillo. I love
it. I will warn people that the villain or the boss in boss level is played by Mel Gibson. So depending on where your comfort level is at seeing Mel Gibson on screen these days may depend on whether or not you want to watch this film. So I don't know. Measure to taste, but he actually takes up very little screen time. He's in the movie for like 5 minutes, basically.
I can deal with that. Yeah. It's all about Frank Grillo anyways. I remember seeing this trailer and I was like, this is weird. He's not in like combat gear. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I can deal with this. So yeah, I'm definitely going to have to put this one up on the queue.
The thing that I found funny and what I originally said was that like Joe Carnahan and Frank Grillo just seemed like this perfect like match made in heaven. If you were going to distill like a personality of a Joe Carnahan film into a single actor, I would think it would be Frank Grillo. On the other hand, it's like taking a film that is a 100-proof bottle of whiskey and saying, you know what this needs? More alcohol. And like, so at a certain point, it almost feels like maybe it's a little bit too much, but also the perfect pairing you could possibly imagine.
Never too much, ever. I love it.
So ultimately, I think the film was enjoyable. I liked it. It's maybe like, if I had a complaint, it's 60 minutes of movie that's crammed into 90 minutes of film. So it's, there's some thin parts, but it was entertaining enough to watch. So
nice.
If you're looking for some good escapist entertainment, you could do a lot worse than boss level.
Love it. Happening.
So the last thing that I've got on my list is a really interesting documentary called A Glitch in the Matrix. And this is from Rodney Asher, who I've followed everything this dude does because his docs are so interesting. But he did the documentary Room 237, which was a big splash at Sundance, which was entirely just people who had some really progressively insane theories about the meaning behind The Shining, talking about their theories played over top of clips of The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really interesting exploration into just like how deep and how far off the rails some people are willing to go when looking into the film, because some of the stuff is some of the theories that people have is like, okay, well, that's like, I can see that as being like a fairly valid reading of the film, all the way up to people like, and this scene is evidence of Kubrick basically acknowledging that he faked the moon landing on a soundstage and filmed it. This is his confession inside The Shining. And it's like, no, you're
crazy. No,
you need to disconnect and watch a different movie, dude. Watch anything else right now, because you've been watching this one too much.
Yeah.
And then he did a follow-up documentary called The Nightmare, which was all about people who suffer from sleep paralysis and the things that they will see during sleep paralysis, which before that documentary, I didn't even know was a thing because I'd never experienced it myself. And then after like raving about the documentary and talking to people, it's like I found out like everyone but me apparently had experienced sleep paralysis, and it's like, holy shit, I didn't even, it all of a sudden this is this big thing in so many people's lives and I didn't even know it existed. And the thing that's interesting about Rodney Asher's documentaries is that he does them very, they all have a very sinister tone. Like, especially The Nightmare, you know, due to the content that's sort of talking about, it very much plays like a horror film, even though it's a documentary. And to a degree, Room 237 as well has like a very sinister tone to it as well. It's just kind of the natural style that he gravitates to, which makes for a really interesting documentary experience. And so his new documentary, A Glitch in the Matrix, I think is very similar to Room 237, but it's all about people who believe in simulation theory, which is the idea that we are all living inside of a simulated computer virtual reality, and that outside in the real world, our bodies are just like hooked up to computers or something like that. There's various different theories that people have, but that we are basically like Neo in the Matrix. We are all just people trapped in the Matrix. And it's been a theory that's been around for a long time. But especially with the advent of the Matrix, it sort of breached into the mainstream. And a lot more people started to delve into it, became a lot more popular, to the point where there's people who genuinely believe, because it hasn't been disproven to them yet, that yes, this is the reality and we are actually all in a fake world. And it's fascinating hearing people make the justification for why they believe that's the case. And it even gets juxtaposed with an interview with a dude who's in prison who basically murdered his whole family after modeling his entire life around the Matrix. Mm-hmm. And it goes to a disturbing length to show the disconnection that some people have from reality in chasing this theory and trying to apply it to their everyday lives. There's one of the people interviewed who makes this extensive spreadsheet about everything going on in his life just so that he can get a bird's eye view of everything he observes and see, oh, I all of a sudden found a pattern here. And because we're humans, we find patterns in anything. Document enough stuff, you'll find a pattern in it. It doesn't necessarily mean anything other than, you know, things are occurring. But it became a consistent thing to this guy that he would see recurring patterns occurring in his life, and that convinced him, yes, we are living in a simulation, because what else could explain that? And it's this bizarre kind of break from reality that is both fascinating and disturbing. And I think the documentary does a really good job of exploring it and also explaining it, what it is, because if it's not something you've entertained, it might feel a little bit foreign.
I'm with you. I've really liked Rodney Asher's films over the years, and I think The Nightmare really does play as this really like even more than Room 237. I liked it more because it did really play with this it walks this fine line of being a documentary and a horror film at the same time. And I like films, especially documentaries, that kind of play with our conception of what a documentary is or should look like. I'm always really interested in what he's working on next. And I find his obsessions are kind of things that are always kind of playing in the back of my mind. So I kind of feel like I have some deep-rooted connection with him. However, I will say this. I really did not like this movie at all in any way, shape, or form. I had a lot of problems with it, which surprised me because I haven't had a lot of time to really unpack it because I literally watched it last night. We had something else I wanted to watch, and Dan's like, I don't want to watch a horror movie. I'm like, fine, we'll watch this, because it was the only other thing I had that I thought might interest him. And I have some concerns. I think for me, I like the fact that Asher usually like goes into these rabbit holes that are kind of like weird, and they feel like a little bit disconnected and out of the ordinary. And it's kind of like this inside look at somebody's obsession. And I would think like in my mind, when I saw the trailer and read the description for this movie, I thought this is like made for me. I love Asher's movies. I love The Matrix. This idea of game theory is something that I've been like thinking about for a long time. I mean, when The Matrix came out, I remember reading like, God, I don't even know how many books I read about theology and mythology of The Matrix and what it meant in psychology. Like it was all consuming. But I found that this was, to me, it just felt like, and I can't quite figure out if it was the, it could be the fact that it's avatars, and I can understand why they use avatars, but it always, it also feels like a, like almost like a cop out that these people are like hiding behind this avatar when they should be like talking, like, as themselves. Like, I want to see the people that are, that have these ideas, because I honestly can't even begin to compute how you let your life get to the point. Like, I see your point, like the whole, you know, you track things for enough time, you're going to start to see patterns. But I'm like, how much, like, it just felt like a lot of navel gazing, because this goes on for, I think the movie's only like 90 minutes long, but it feels like it's 5 hours long because it's so infuriating and kind of boring to listen to these people just talk around in circles about this thing over and over and over again. I'm like, I would have much rather listened to the entire Philip K. Dick essay reading than listen to these guys exploit about their fascinations with the Matrix. And then they have the one lone woman that actually makes the probably the most interesting points in the entire movie. And then I started to think, maybe what this movie needs is more of a female perspective. Like, then I'm starting to think, like, maybe this is playing into me. Like, I have no idea, but I have mixed feelings. But my general knee jerk is I didn't really care for it. It felt kind of cheap. You can tell it was made probably during the pandemic because all of the interviews look really badly captured. Like, the whole thing, like, just didn't work for me on any level. And I was like, yeah, no, not happening. But I did appreciate the fact that he did dig into that Dick essay, like that talk that he did in Paris. I'd never heard that before. So I thought that was really, really interesting. I mean, Dick was kind of crazy anyways. He was a crazy drug addict, but he had some fascinating ideas. And I have read a lot of his stuff, especially a lot of his essays. And that's not something that I had seen before. That was by far for me the most interesting thing about the whole movie. The whole thing just rubbed me the wrong way. I don't know why, it just did.
No, that's disappointing that you didn't.
No, I really wanted to like it, but I really didn't.
I can totally see that. And I think you're absolutely right that this was a pandemic movie. All of the interviews are over Zoom. The avatar thing, because all of the interviewees basically are given their own sort of CG animated avatar that sort of replaces them in the Zoom call. Which I think that achieves two things. I mean, one is kind of like, you know, it's thematically on point with what is being talked about in the film. And it also kind of abstracts to a certain degree the person from their ideas, which I think is kind of an interesting way to go about it. It's like his solution in room 237 is there's just no original footage in that film at all. It's just audio. And then all of the visuals are cut from The Shining and other films. And fun fact that I learned listening to a Q&A of the director about Room 237 is that film screened at Sundance and even got into a bidding war for distributors, and he did not own any of the footage in that documentary. He had not gotten approval for any of the footage in it, and suddenly it became a legal question about if the film even could be distributed, which I'm kind of amazed that Sundance even screened it without him having chain of custody on the rights for everything in the film. But, you know, that's what happened with that one, and he got away with it because all of the footage was talking about it was about the films that was being discussed, and so he was able to be able to use it under fair use. And so that's kind of the trade-off that happens in Glitch in the Matrix, is yes, we're going to show the people talking, but we're going to abstract them into avatars so that it is just about what they're talking about and not about the people themselves. But I think you bring up a really good point, how you have all of these dudes with all of these crazy theories, and then you have this one woman who's basically like a sole point of logic.
Yes, she's the voice of reason in the entire thing.
In the film. And it just makes me think about how, like, look at QAnon. It's all mostly white dudes. It's like there's not a lot of people of color that fall into QAnon, and there's a reason they have crap to deal with in their lives that they can't take the time for crazy conspiracy theories. Who can? Privileged white dudes. They got the time for crazy conspiracy theories. Like, we're all living in a simulation.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And so maybe that's part of the aspect. Maybe it's like a dudes with too much time on their hand and not enough problems in their life issue. I don't know.
I will say,
I'm very broadly casting aspersions here.
I will also say the other thing that I found really interesting that I wish he dealt with more and leaned into more was when they started talking about Minecraft, and there was the one expert who was talking about how his 12 or 14 year old daughter is she and her friends are looking through their old Minecraft levels and, you know, getting all excited about the music that they were listening to at the time. And I mean, I don't know anything about Minecraft, so but that observation I thought was really interesting, and I wish they would have dealt with more about this idea of nostalgia and gaming, especially like in an immersive worlds. And mm-hmm. I thought that was like kind of that's not what the movie was about, but because they touched on it, I'm like, oh, that kind of feels like a bit of a missed opportunity. And I kind of hope he delves into that at some point, because I thought that was really interesting and not really explored enough. And those concepts, I think, are way more interesting than, I just felt like, to me, I didn't feel the disconnection between the characters, the people, and their stories. And to me, it just felt like a lot of navel-gazing, these guys talking about how they, you know, they obsessed over whatever thing. And to me, that didn't feel like it was universal enough. It felt very specific, and the universality of it just kind of got lost on me. And I think that's why I had issues with it. But there's certain other aspects of the movie that I did think worked really, really well, that I just wish they would have, you know, delved into a little bit more. But that's not the movie that he was presenting, so I mean, it's totally understandable. Yeah.
That's totally fair, and I don't think the film was ever intending to apply universality.
No.
Again, this is why I kind of sort of linked the film to Room 237 quite a bit, because in a very similar way, it's about very niche people with very fringe theories about a film that is at this point 50 years old, and it's not something that most people are ever going to identify with, the things that they hear in that movie or have even thought about.
Yeah.
But instead it becomes a slice of like, holy shit, there are people who consume themselves with this, and I've never even considered it.
Yeah.
Nor would I.
Yeah.
Because it's just not something that is important to my life, but it has consumed these people's lives. They have based their life around it. And I think Glitch in the Matrix kind of gets at that too, where it's like, these are people who are on the fringes who have bought into some very sketchy fringe ideas, and they have let it dictate their lives.
Yeah.
And there is something that is, I don't want to say subversively, but it is compelling in a way of almost like looking at a train wreck. I don't want to be that mean and say train wreck, but it's like there is a lack of understanding about where these people are coming from that I can't help but find just engrossing, in that it's like, I want to know where these people are coming from, because I do not understand
it
at all.
Yeah, it's so far removed from what we perceive as our reality that it's like, how did you get to that point?
And I think for me, there was like this added layer. It's like, I think with A Glitch in the Matrix, I think I do understand a tiny bit, because I do think that the Matrix, like, I still remember seeing that movie in 1999. I remember walking out of the theater, and I remember like stepping out onto Granville Street in Vancouver and looking up at the sky, and it was like raining, and it almost felt like the rain looked different to me. The film had in a way altered my worldview, if only temporarily, because it had presented to me all these ideas about how we perceive the world around us. And for this brief period, when I stepped out of the film, before I readjusted to reality again, it was like, I am perceiving things differently about the world now, and probably, you know, still to this day, perceive the world a little bit differently because of this one film experience. And to me, that's kind of exemplary of the most powerful type of filmic experience that we can possibly have. I mean, people talk about 2001 this way, how it completely changed their perception of the universe. And I think when we can have those experiences with a film that is incredibly profound and causes us to actually change our perspective in a way in how we view the world, that's incredibly powerful stuff.
Agreed.
And I kind of get that. And I kind of understand how people could have gone down the "we do live in a simulation" rabbit hole. I understand how someone gets there. I understand how I could have gotten there. Except for the fact that, you know, I also am not ready to disconnect from reality. So it's, and seeing these people who did do that, who did, in a way, disconnect from reality and go fully down that rabbit hole, it's maybe from just like an old, my own self perspective, it's maybe like a little bit of a disturbing road, thank God I didn't travel kind of thing. I don't think I ever would have gone there, but I can see a version of myself that did, and I don't like that.
Yeah. God damn it. I don't want you to bring me around on this movie. I still don't like it.
I will win you over on A Glitch in the Matrix 2021 campaign.
Oh, you're almost there. You're almost there. I still will not see it again. So there. That's where I put my foot down.
I'll probably end up watching like Room 237 and definitely The Nightmare again before I watch Glitch in the Matrix. I think it's probably Rodney's worst film. And by worst film, that's like a very like, they're all high bars in my opinion, because I think his films, they sit in a league of their own. No one is making documentaries the way he makes them. And so it's really hard to sort of like compare his documentaries to anything else. They're unique experiences.
Yeah.
So even though I think that his other films are all better than A Glitch in the Matrix, I did really like A Glitch in the Matrix a lot. And I think if any of this conversation is even vaguely interesting to you, you'll probably get something out of the documentary and it's worth watching.
Agreed. I can go with that. Just because I didn't like it doesn't mean somebody else won't.
Yes, I win.
Whatever. And with that, do you have anything else? I really
no. That is the end of my list.
So we'll leave it there. We'll link to all the stuff that we talked about today in the show notes. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more discussion. I'm sure we'll find something else to. It's not even an argument at this point. It's just a conversation. But we'll find something else to talk about. So until then, come on by atcpod.ca, and we'll talk to you all soon.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.